Salut, mes amis. Clyde Rabideau here, mayor of Saranac Lake, the capital of the Adirondacks. And I'm here because my friend Joey asked me to be here and to introduce his podcast show, From the Hip Radio. It's a two-hour weekly podcast where you hear great music, thoughtful commentary, and compelling interviews, along with features addressing a wide variety of subjects. And this comes from his experience as a good Catholic boy, growing up in Davenport, Iowa, going to Assumption High School, being taught by the nuns of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and he's made it all the way here to Saranac Lake, the capital of the Adirondacks, to do this podcast. And I know his brothers and sisters and his mom and dad in heaven, with their Irish lilt and their Irish gift of storytelling, will appreciate this show. Amen. Hallelujah.
Thanks, Clyde. I just love that introduction. You might hear some clinking dishes in the background. That was our friend Woogie Carolus, the third wheel of our Saturday morning walks that often end up at Woogie's house with him cooking us a mammoth breakfast and then cleaning up afterwards. Thanks, Woog. So we'll start off the show with some Latin music straight from, well, Richmond, Virginia. This is the percussionist and singer Kevin Davis with his band, Band Caribe. Kevin plays percussion in Robert Jospe's Inner Rhythm out of Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where I first heard Kevin play. Then he told us of his own band, and we got the organizers of a local Friday night concert series in Stanton to hire them. Nobody sits when this group plays. So here's Kevin Davis and Band Caribe with a song called Latin R&B.
King of Latin soul, I've got the rhythm in me. The Duke of Latin swing, swinging to the mambo beat. The rhythm and blues makes it all so smooth. Latin R&B, very perfect harmony. Rumba. When the drums are calling, whistle, there's an Afro clave beat staring in my soul. A soulful melody, whistle. I feel the Latin R&B, and it brings it on home. The rhythm makes me move. I've got the spirit in me. I just can't keep still. Crazy about that Latin beat. Rhythm and blues makes it all so smooth. Latin R&B, very perfect harmony. When the drums are calling, whistle, there's an Afro clave beat staring in my soul. I hear a soulful melody, whistle. I feel the Latin R&B, and it rings it all I play that Afro beat, turns me on. I can
And that's Kevin Davis and Band Caribe out of Richmond, Virginia. Now, those of you my age remember the cartoon music group, the Archies. They had a number one hit with Sugar, Sugar. That song pretty much defined bubblegum music, and we hated bubblegum music. But that song went number one on the Billboard charts and remained there for 4 weeks. What I found a little curious, though, was all the groups that covered that song. Ike and Tina Turner, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Tom Jones, and even Gladys Knight. And yes, I am going to play a version. But this one is fabulous. I guess it's not what you sing, but how you sing it. And just listen to these horns. Here's Wilson Pickett's version of Sugar, Sugar.
Sugar. Honey, honey. You are my candy girl. You got me wanting you. Oh, honey. Sugar, sugar.
Sugar, Sugar by Wilson Pickett. A few years ago, I was busy playing solo guitar and singing on the local restaurant and resort circuit. I also got calls to do nursing home gigs, which turned out to be more fun than you might think. In Lake Placid, there's a nursing facility that was started by the Sisters of Mercy. It has recently been taken over by a private group, but there's still a small Catholic presence there. So I was setting up my equipment in the garden area, and few of the residents were showing up, some being wheeled in. An elderly woman says to me, "So your name is Dockery, eh?" I looked up and said, "Yes, Joe Dockery." "Sounds Irish," she says. "Well, yes, it is." "I'm a Murphy," she said. She goes on to tell me about her trip years ago to Ireland, which, like any story about Ireland, I was very interested in. So the gig goes on, and between songs I engage the audience, and sometimes the back and forth can get a little lively. There was a comment made about a fella who didn't show up, and then another comment about his likely whereabouts that brought out quite a chuckle. I figured out what was being implied, and no one laughed harder than Mrs. Murphy. So when I was finished with the gig, the gang dispersed except for the ones in the wheelchairs who had to wait to be escorted back to their rooms by an attendant. As I was rolling up my mic cord, I thought, here's my chance. Old Mrs. Murphy seemed to be game for a good joke, even if it bordered on the risque. So I says, "Hey, Mrs. Murphy, what was the birthday wish of the 18-year-old Irish lass?" "Well, I don't know," she says. "What was the birthday wish of the 18-year-old Irish lass?" And I answer, "Lord have Murphy on me tonight." Well, she didn't respond much, even though I think that joke is hilarious. As I was finishing packing my gear, the attendant comes over to her and says, "Sister Marie, did you enjoy the music?" Oh my God. I just told a dirty joke to a nun. and that is Karen Savoca on vocals and percussion, and her husband Pete Heitzman on guitars. My brother Tom saw them perform in Chicago in the 90s and told me how good they were. And then, not too long after that, I was negotiating getting Greg Brown to come to Stanton for our concert series there. We agreed on a price, and then his booking agent asked if we would mind if Karen and Pete could open the show for him since they would be touring with him at the same time. I said, for sure. And yes, Tom was right. They were fabulous. Well then, as fate would have it, years later up here in Saranac Lake, I find out that they're from Syracuse, New York. So I contacted them and hired them to play here in Saranac Lake for our summer concert series. Man, it's so fun when things like that happen. Hear the heartbeat? This is Los Lobos reminding us we're all the same. We all have dreams. They may be fleeting, so never forget, we always will have each other.
150 miles from Mexico to LA. Doesn't seem that far, but still a world away. Went up to see your husband, Tony, who left some years ago. He wrote to say, come be with me, I miss and love you so. Promise that I'll care for you, wrote Tony to his wife, now and for the rest of my life. Tony washes dishes, Maria, she sweeps floors. The dreams that they once had, well, they don't have. Instead, she stares up at the ceiling while most are fast asleep. She thinks about her babies and prays the Lord their souls to keep. We promised that we'd care for them, said Tony to his wife, now and for the rest of our lives.
I swear, that's the heartbeat of us all. Let's promise to care for one another, now and for the rest of our lives. Los Lobos, from their album Good Morning Aztlan, with Tony E. Maria. Sometime in the mid-90s, I received a pirated cassette tape of a band that I had never heard of before. Some fella just thought I'd like the band, so he made a copy for me. The memory of who gave it to me faded quick, because one time while the cassette was playing, someone asked me who the band was and how I had heard about them. All I could tell them was that the name of the band was Great Big Sea, and there was no other identifying information on the tape, so I had no idea where they were from. I hadn't seen their names on any festival lineups and figured they were just a really good local band from somewhere. They played Irish-styled rock music, sea shanties, and beautiful ballads. The cassette was on my car stereo rotation of road music that I would listen to. Yes, cars still had tape players back in the 90s. I'll tell you more about that band, but first I'll play the first cut from that album. Here's Great Big Sea and Runaway. So you can see how they got my attention. Great musicians, cool harmony, and a wonderful spirit. So 10 years or so goes by, and I'm not hearing their name anywhere, but I'm not looking either. I figured I just got lucky to get a hold of some rare recording of a local band somewhere. Then one night in the mid-2000s, I was perusing the weekend section of the Washington Post, just seeing who was in town, and I saw an ad for Great Big Sea playing at the Warner Theater. Well, that certainly caught my attention. But I was more than a little surprised, because the Warner Theater is this beautiful, ornate theater in D.C., and they host some of the biggest acts in the world, from classical to rock. I was worried the Great Big Sea might have a hard time filling the place. I had played the tape for Mary Lynn before, and even though she didn't remember the band, she was still up for going. So I got on Ticketmaster to see if I could get some tickets, and sure enough, I did. In the sixth row. Now I was really worried. The gig was a week away, and they had only sold six rows of seats. So I'm thinking, what would it be like if we sit in a near-empty theater listening to this band? I started to feel sorry for them, actually, and I really wasn't sure if I wanted to even go. Oh well, the gig was on a Sunday night, and I knew we could at least spend a Sunday afternoon hanging out in one of my favorite cities. And I knew a good Vietnamese restaurant nearby where we could have a nice, healthy pre-concert dinner. So the next week, I traveled up to Northern Virginia from Stanton, and I picked up Mary Lynn, and we drove to a metro station and took the subway into City Center, Washington, D.C. We spent the afternoon walking the mall and visiting the Vietnam War Memorial, something that always moves me to tears. If you haven't been, it's a must-stop in D.C. We also visited the National Art Gallery and sat on the Capitol steps looking out on the mall toward the Washington Monument. On the way to dinner, we stopped at Ford's Theater, where I never get tired of visiting. It's restored to look as it did the night Lincoln was shot, and the intimacy of it illuminates your mind, and you can put yourself right there and clearly imagine the moment it happened. So sitting at dinner two blocks from the theater, I was satisfied that the day was a success no matter the outcome of the concert. We left the restaurant and walked along F Street towards 13th Street. The whole downtown seemed unusually quiet since it was a Sunday night, and the city just seemed to be at rest. As we walked along, I once again mentioned to Mary Lynn how unlikely it would be to have this arena filled of 2,000 seats after having sold only six rows of seats within a week of the show. And we were resigned to leaving at intermission if the show didn't work out, having had a full day already. So I'm about in mid-sentence when we turned the corner onto 13th Street, and when we did, we both just stopped in our tracks. Up ahead, halfway down the block, there were at least four large tour buses parked out front and a horde of people mingling, spilling into the street. We were shocked, although feeling a little better for the band. As we got closer, I noticed the marquee. It read, "Tonight, Great Big C, sold out." What? Who are these guys? And why have I not heard of them other than the pirated cassette I had been listening to? We entered the crowded foyer, and amidst these people, you could feel a palpable excitement in the air. Folks were talking away, buying drinks at the makeshift bar, and shopping at the portable merchandise tables. Whoa, man. Clearly, we were at an event. We entered the theater, which is always a thrill because of its palatial decor. And with the curtain raised, exposing the stage, colorful lights shone down behind the huge, ornate proscenium, creating a magical scene. Four mics spread abreast, guitars on stands in a row, amplifiers in the background straddling the riser where the drum set sat, all dormant for now, but ready for action. Man, I got goosebumps just talking about it. Our seats were at the end of the row, so we just stood together against the wall and took in the whole scene. Two 20-something young men walked into the row just behind us, and as they passed, one of the men in total elation exclaimed, "I can't believe you got me Great Big C tickets for my birthday." Mary Lynn and I just looked at each other and thought, "Where are we?" Then I saw a couple large flags being waved from the balcony, red and white flags, with a large maple leaf in the middle. Whoa, those are Canadian flags. Ah, now I'm starting to get it. These guys are from Canada. And, well, I'm embarrassed to say, but that could be why they've been off my radar. And one other curious thing we noticed was the age spread among the audience. There were mostly young fans, but also there were more than you would expect, over 50 and under 15. It gave the impression of a family gathering. As we sat there within a snowball's throw from front and center stage, I was still confused as to how I got such premier seats only a week before. Surely they didn't sell out in such a short time. Then I remembered our experience in promoting concerts ourselves and how the artists always want us to reserve 10 tickets or so for family members and friends. Then if they don't use those tickets, they let us know nearing the date of the gig so that we could sell those tickets. That's what must have happened. Being so far from their homes in St. John's, Newfoundland, these fellas gave up the tickets the week before, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Wow, how fortunate. So the lights go down, and the band walks out on the stage. The place goes wild, and I once again marvel at the surprise that this evening was granting us. The lead singer, Alan Doyle, walks to the front mic and greets everyone, and then goes on to comment quite befittingly on how beautiful this theater was. He says, "We've played in plenty of sucky places before." And then as the laughter dies down, he says, "And this is the least sucky place we've ever played." And then it started. 1, 2, 3, 4, and off goes the band. The audience seemed to know all the lyrics of every song, and the band was eager to let them sing along. Flags waving, fists in the air, people jumping. I tell you, it was pure joy. We were dancing in the aisles. You couldn't help but think there was pent-up nationalist pride being expressed, too. It was like, "We are Canadians, and you're welcome to come along for the ride. This is our band, and we are proud." Well, they have reason to be proud. Great Big C are national heroes among our neighbors to the north, having played sold-out shows wherever they performed. Alan Doyle and Sean McCann still do solo tours, but the band is broken up. Those of you who've seen them live, you know what I'm talking about. I'm just glad that one night at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C., I caught lightning in a bottle.
I've got a smile on my face, and I've got four walls around me. I've got the sun in the sky, all the water surround me. So big, and I said,
wait, hey, just an ordinary day,
and it's all your state of mind. At the end of the day, you just got to say it's all right.
Well,
Jeannie sings on the corner, what keeps her from dying? She won't stop trying. Oh, you know, she might stumble, they push her around. She might fall, but she'll never lie down. It's not so bad. And I say,
wait, it's just an ordinary day,
and it's all your state of mind. At the end of the day, you just got to say it's all right.
Oh, yeah.
It's all right, it's all right.
Get up, get up, get up, get up, go!
There's always some sorrow. It's a double-edged knife, but there's always tomorrow. Oh, you know, it's up to you now. If you sink or swim, just keep the faith that your ship will come in. It's not so bad.
Great Big Sea, An Ordinary Day. Well, speaking of Canadians, here's one of the greatest songwriters of all time. Joni Mitchell has always worn her heart on her sleeve. Her lyrics, so often revealing her own open wounds, grant us the gift of opening a window into our own lives, allowing us to face some uncomfortable truths. So is it true that Joni never really loved, as this next song implies? That it's all been just a false alarm? Boy, I hope not. I just want Joni to feel the same peace she has helped me gain over the years.
I was driving across the burning desert when I spotted six jet planes leaving six white vapor trails across the bleak terrain. It was the hexagram of the heavens. It was the strings of my guitar. Amelia, it was just a false alarm.
Okay.
Joni Mitchell, comparing herself with Amelia Earhart in this metaphor for the futility of love. Such a beautiful song, though, with Joni on that haunting rhythm guitar driving the song, along with Larry Carlton and Victor Feldman coloring it up in the background on guitar and vibes. Now I think we need something a little lighter. Here's the Englishman, Richard Thompson, with his song, Nearly in Love. He's just not quite sure if he's really falling in love, or is it just a dose of the flu that gives me the chills for you? Richard Thompson from his album Daring Adventures. You know, the planet we live on is truly a superorganism. It possesses all the necessary elements to sustain life and is curiously the exact distance from the sun to not only receive its benefits but also ward off its harmful and destructive effects. The balance that holds all this together can be fragile considering the current warming of our planet, convincingly due to man's use and development of fossil fuels. But what we're going to talk about today is water. Without water, or the availability of fresh water specifically, certainly human life could not exist. We depend on water to deliver essential nutrients to our tissues and eliminate harmful waste. It aids in the breakdown of these nutrients for the use in our bodies, and it dilutes and helps neutralize otherwise poisonous elements in the environment that we're exposed to. Today, my guest is Corey Laxon. a limnologist who studies the lakes here in the Adirondacks. Corey has a master's degree in aquatic ecology and is an instructor at Paul Smith College in the Department of Natural Sciences. I know you will enjoy our discussion. So I'm sitting here in the office with Corey Laxon, our limnologist from Paul Smith College and associate professor of ecology and aquatic sciences. Corey, welcome to From the Hip Radio.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be here.
It is great to be here. I really appreciate you coming over. Now, so that's a word that I learned when I first met you was limnologist. And could you explain exactly what is a limnologist?
Yeah, sure. No, it needs explanation. A lot of people will ask me what I do or what classes I teach, and I'll say limnology, and they look at me like they know what I'm talking about, but I can tell that they don't. And a lot of people think I work with legs and arms.
Yeah. Limnologist, of course.
Right. So what limnology is sort of the root of that word comes from the Greek word limne, which is a pool or a marsh, and the Greek word logos, the discourse of or the study of. Right. So it's the study, essentially, of fresh water. Limnology tends to really focus on lakes, but of course, you can't study a lake, you can't understand a lake without also looking at what goes in and out of the lake.
Saltwater limnologist, that would be an oceanographer, is that correct?
That's right.
And what got you interested in the study of lakes?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I've always had my feet wet. Whenever I had an opportunity to go in a ditch or capture frogs, tadpoles, crayfish, I've always been interested in fresh water.
And where did you grow up, Corey?
Good reasons why we need to take the surface water on the planet serious. And most of the organisms that are alive on the planet live in water. Oceans, primarily freshwater as well. Another reason we need to care about water is demand. You know, Earth is like this blue planet, right? It's covered in water. But when you think about how much of that is fresh water that's actually usable by humans, amount relative to our blue planet. On that relatively small amount of usable water, there is a huge demand for that water. So if you take however many hundreds of thousands of cubic kilometers of fresh water is, I don't know the number.
Right.
If you divide it by our population size, almost 8 billion people, our physiological needs, right? So it's plenty of water. But you start factoring in issues related to our industry and our population growth, that water gets sucked down pretty quick. So there's domestic, diverse amount of research on the around the Adirondacks related to water, watersheds. Lakes are an integral part of, you know, of our biome, of our larger environment. And there's some really good reasons why we need to take the surface water on the planet serious. And most of the organisms that are alive on the planet live in water. Oceans, primarily freshwater as well. Another reason we need to care about water is demand. You know, Earth is like this blue planet, right? It's covered in water. But when you think about how much of that is fresh water that's actually usable by humans or by freshwater organisms, it's a small, tiny, tiny fraction of all the water on the planet, oceans, polar ice caps, the atmosphere, lakes, rivers. About 0.3% of that is usable by humans.
Now, that's an interesting fact.
So it's actually a really small amount relative to our blue planet. On that relatively small amount of usable water, there is a huge demand for that water. So if you take however many cubic, hundreds of thousands of cubic kilometers of fresh water is, I don't know the number.
Right.
If you divide it by our population size, almost 8 billion people, I think.
Right.
It gives us about 11,000 liters per person per day. So that's plenty, right?
You would think.
We only need 2 to 4 liters a day for our physiological needs, right? So it's plenty of water. But you start factoring in issues related to our industry and our population growth, that water gets sucked down pretty quick. So there's domestic needs for things like wastewater, car washes, watering the lawn, doing the dishwasher, right. running the dishwasher. Then there's industrial demand.
Fracking, I understand, takes a tremendous amount of water.
Yeah. Then on top of all that, the biggest demand is agricultural demand, which can be thousands of liters per person per day. So there's a lot of pressure on really a small amount of usable water. In the Adirondacks, we don't think about that because there's so much fresh water. So much. But of course, across the whole planet, not everyone has that much water.
Right. Interesting. Well, now, and what about the health of the water here in the Adirondacks?
We're very fortunate here because we just have so many lakes and ponds, you know, so many. 11,111 lakes and ponds in the Adirondacks is the precise number. And most of that water is really in a least impacted condition. So sure, it's impacted by things that come from the atmosphere and it's impacted by climate change, but they're protected. So the water quality in many Adirondack lakes is excellent. Now, of course, the closer you get to development, to towns, villages, to roadways, that's where we start to see a lot more impact.
So when I moved to the Adirondacks, acid rain was a big issue. And what I was told was that the Adirondacks were successful in managing the acid rain, and that there at one time were actually dead lakes. Is that true, that there had actually been dead lakes in the Adirondacks? And if so, could you describe what a dead lake is?
That term, dead lake, has it's kind of a term that attracts a lot of attention, and it's used in that way. But whether
it's lakes, very ominous.
There's still quite a lot of life, even in lakes that are impacted. But what acid rain has done, is greatly decrease the amount of species richness and species diversity. The most amount of research that was done in that topic was certainly on freshwater fish. Fish received, you know, the lion's share of research in terms of acid rain impact. And many of these lakes that were classified as dead lakes had a significant loss in the amount of fish and invertebrates in that water. You know, for example, research that was done in the 1980s by one of our local researchers, Walt Kretzer, when he was working for the Adirondack Lake Survey Corporation, they looked at the chemistry, the biology, they sampled fish. They found 53 species of freshwater fish across the Adirondacks that were found. When you take that list of fish and you only look at fish that exist in lakes that have a pH of 5.5 or less, so very acidic, 64% of the fish species are not there.
Wow.
So we've got all this fish diversity up here, but when lakes become very acidic and their pH falls like into the mid fives, we see a massive decrease in the amount of, in the species richness of fish. Invertebrates also often suffer because of acid deposition for the simple fact that invertebrates have an exoskeleton made of calcium carbonate. And when the water gets acidic, it becomes very difficult to construct these calcium carbonate exoskeletons. So invertebrates get hit really hard as well.
Right.
And this is what
a dead
lake is.
These invertebrates, you're talking about crayfish and...
Certainly crayfish, mollusks, zooplankton. There's a huge change in the species richness and diversity when a lake becomes acidified. So this is what a dead lake is when you find this lake that has really low pH. It also has incredibly low or even absent fish biomass and very low biomass of invertebrates, plus a whole suite of other changes to the biology because the lake's become acidified.
And is acid rain a problem currently?
Yes, it's still a problem. It is, in a lot of ways, a great success story, though. Well, I guess what I should also say, too, is, you know, the term we like to use is acid deposition. Because acid deposition can be wet, like acid rain, acid snow, acid hail, acidic cloud water.
Acid clouds, right.
Yeah. And it can also be dry. There's dry deposition. So aerosols on dust that settle to the ground also contributes to this acidic problem. So we like to use the word acid deposition because it's not just acid rain.
Right.
Nitpicky, but this is the term.
No, I understand. So dust is being carried in the atmosphere, in the air, just as much as a cloud would be.
Absolutely. So overall, the amendments to the Clean Air Act. So the Clean Air Act was in 1970.
Mm-hmm. President Nixon.
That was really important, but most of that Clean Air Act was to protect respiratory health of Americans. It wasn't really about atmospheric pollution that ended up falling somewhere else's rain. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until 1990 that amendments to the Clean Air Act specifically outlined ways to curb acid deposition. Mm-hmm. So since 1994, we've seen a very, very significant decrease in the amount of, we'll just say, acid falling from the sky.
Right. It's sulfuric acid and...
Sulfuric acid and nitric acid.
Nitric acid, right. And that acid is produced by...
It's produced when petroleum products and fossil fuels, particularly coal, are combusted. Some of the gases that are given off are oxides of sulfur and nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So those sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides go up into the atmosphere, into the low atmosphere. They react with water and oxygen to form nitric and sulfuric acid.
Right. But there's not a lot of coal burning going on here in the Adirondacks. Why would the Adirondacks be suffering with acid rain?
Well, there's been a lot of coal burning in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And the prevailing winds bring the products of combustion up towards the Adirondacks. It's not just an Adirondack problem.
Mm-hmm. The government intervened, and how did they clean up the atmosphere then? What kind of regulations did the government put on these power plants?
Yeah, the details, I don't know that I could come up with.
I think they were like scrubbers in the stacks, the smokestacks.
Yeah, there were scrubbers in the smokestacks. There was limits.
But that has resulted in a real victory for the environment.
It has. We've seen a substantial decrease in the amount of acid falling from the sky. But the interesting thing is we've seen really only a partial recovery in the lakes. Recovery from acid deposition is a very complicated area.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you know, the acid deposition has fundamentally altered the chemistry of the watersheds around in the Adirondacks. And when you fundamentally alter the chemistry of the watershed, you can't just go back to normal because it's been altered.
Mm-hmm.
So with the decrease that we've seen in acid deposition over the last 30 years, we've seen a lot of really positive improvements in many of the lakes. Many lakes have seen their pH rise, less acidic. It's hard to see the recovery signal in acid deposition because we're also seeing changing climate. We're also seeing more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We're also seeing a really significant signal from road salt. We're seeing in non-native species coming into lakes. So there's all these complex interacting environmental problems that often complicate recovery or mask recovery. So it hasn't like, oh, we turn the switch way down on acid deposition, so now all the lakes should go back to quote-unquote normal. And that's not what's happening.
Right. And what about the salt deposition from the salt that we put on the roads? Is that quite a problem here in the Adirondacks?
It is quite a problem. The amount of salt that's applied to roads in any northern environment, but particularly in New York State and in the Adirondacks, there is so much salt applied to the road. Mm-hmm. A colleague of mine, Dan Kelting at the Adirondack Watershed Institute, and I did a report like 10 years ago where we tried really hard to get a handle on what that number is, how much salt is put down on roads in the Adirondacks. And we made an estimate that there's about 38 tons of road salt applied to each lane mile in the Adirondacks.
And what does the salt do?
Road salt can have a number of impacts on the freshwater system. We're just starting to really understand what they are, though. all of the biodiversity living in our lakes and streams, they're freshwater organisms. They have evolved to live in water with low salinity. When you get all this salt applied to the roads, it eventually, either directly through a gutter or slowly through the soil, makes it into a receiving water and elevates the salinity. And what can happen is the salt level can get so high that these organisms are not adapted to live with it.
Right.
They're living in a very dilute environment, fresh water. Yet aquatic organisms inside their tissue is very salty. It's a high level of ions inside their body. So there's this great adaptation between the freshwater environment they live in and their salty insides. Mm-hmm. So there's this osmotic balance that has to be maintained. And when the salinity of the lake increases, that osmotic balance goes out of whack.
Right. What would you say is the largest detrimental effect that we have environmentally on a lake?
The biggest issue for lakes in the Adirondacks right now that we need to really keep our eye on is non-native species.
You know, invasive species.
Well, mm-hmm. invasive and non-native, mm-hmm. non-indigenous species. There's so mm-hmm. much, the nomenclature for these have gotten out of control, but...
Isn't it a situation where the lake will just eventually evolve to be able to handle these species? Well, I hate to use the word predators, but is that a case in plant species as it is in animal species?
Well, I think that can happen, but in order for that to happen, you've totally now changed the ecosystem of the lake. Mm-hmm. And that probably requires several non-native species, and the loss of many endemic or native species, changes in the food web dynamics. There's a whole host of environmental problems that can occur when you rapidly shift the biota in a system. Mm-hmm. And it's really something that's important to think about, because what we're witnessing right now is the greatest translocation of species that has ever occurred on the planet Earth.
And why is that?
Well, we're literally moving species around from one end of the globe to the other. I mean...
On boats and on...
Species, species have the capacity to move from one lake to another lake very slowly over time or over geologic time, but they're not adapted to, you know, make it across huge geographic borders or across oceans or through mountain ranges. But what humans have done is they've punched holes in all these barriers for species to move. So they travel on boats, you know, they travel in cargo ships. They're released intentionally from aquariums into a new environment where they potentially have no predators, or they have unlimited amount of food, or and the ability to really change the way the system works. I mean, look at the poster child invasive species in freshwater has been, I bet you know what it is.
Milfoil.
No.
Oh.
Well, yes, but even before, the zebra mussel.
Hmm.
The zebra mussel, when that species came from Eurasia into the Great Lakes, we had no idea the kind of impact it was going to create.
Okay. So this is an animal. We're not talking about a plant. We're talking
this
about
an animal. Mm-hmm. This is a mussel,
right,
that has fundamentally altered the way the Great Lakes system works from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly prolific.
Mm-hmm.
They reproduce really, really fast. And they're mussels, so they're sessile. They don't move. They attach themselves. So the zebra mussel can completely colonize any hard surface on the bottom, whether it's rock or a log, sunken log, or a shopping cart, whatever is on the bottom of the water, it grows on. And they multiply in really huge numbers. And then because they're mussels, they're pulling water through their in-current siphon across their gill and filtering out food. So they're feeding on fine particulate organic material.
Mm-hmm.
So they're filtering out the water,
mm-hmm.
Which has done a number of things in the Great Lakes. It's increased the transparency of the lake by huge amounts. I grew up on a cottage on Lake Erie, and when I was a kid, it was thick, it was green, you couldn't see very far. Now you go out there, you can see down 10-15 meters
into
the water.
So clear water isn't necessarily better than cloudy water,
right,
because the cloudy water has these particulates that are extremely important. Who else depends on this particulate matter?
Native plankton, native mussels, zooplankton. So But what they've done is they've pulled all that biomass out of the water, all that energy out of the water, and they eat it, and then they defecate it out all around them. So they've shifted the major productivity of the Great Lakes from being algae up in the surface water to being a detrital food web down at the bottom. It's a complicated topic, but it's a major shift in the way that the Great Lakes work.
Mm-hmm.
From being pelagic-based productivity to, mm-hmm. to almost being benthic.
Is there anything being done about the issue?
But no, they can't be eradicated. So what we have to do is protect water bodies, particularly in the Adirondacks, where we're in a situation where we've got minimal impact from non-native species. Yes, we have a dozen non-native species or so. They can't. We got to stop them from spreading, and we got to stop the new ones from coming in.
Mm-hmm. Now, humans are certainly not going to stop being mobile. The more people we have on this planet, the more migration is going to occur. So is this something that you think that, as far as invasive species are concerned, is this something you think that we can have a handle on or get a handle on as the years go by? Or do you think that we're inevitably what's going to happen is that there's going to be sort of a homogeny of species as a result of this international travel?
I think that we, particularly in the Adirondacks, we've done an amazing job in getting education out to the people about the problems of non-native species and getting cooperation and compliance at boat launches for moving species around.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're doing about as good as a job as can be done. And the effort that's being done in the Adirondacks is now being copied and emulated by a lot of other agencies across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think at some point the world is just going to become a monoculture. Or
Corey, are you encouraged by the attention that lakes get from the government as far as keeping these lakes healthy?
Yes, I'm very happy to be living in the Adirondacks, where our regional government and our state government have a vested interest
mm-hmm.
in the health and quality of the lake. And the other thing that we really have going for us in the Adirondacks is we have many non-government organizations that are absolutely dedicated to protecting the water quality of the Adirondacks.
Mm-hmm. In the future, Corey, do you think it's going to be non-government organizations who are going to be able to clean up this planet, or do you think that government organizations will help to clean up the planet?
Well, the federal government has demonstrated that it can be helpful in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Clean Water Act in the 1970s was absolutely transformational
mm-hmm.
to the quality of surface water. There's even plenty of stories of lakes in the Adirondacks that were heavily impacted
mm-hmm.
by nutrient and sewage pollution that the Clean Water Act helped clean up. So the federal government has demonstrated that they can do it. It's just been quite a while since they've done anything to really help surface water that we can see.
Corey Laxon, thank you so much for the conversation today. I really appreciate it, and you've enlightened me, and I'm certainly, you know, many of our listeners, I'm sure.
Thanks, Joe.
You are welcome. Good luck to you, Corey, in the future.
All right, bye-bye.
I face the barren waste without the taste of water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water, cool, clear water. The nights are cool and I'm a fool, each star's a pool of water, cool water. And with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water, cool, clear water. Keep a moving.
him, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water. The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water, cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water, cool, clear. Moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me?
That's Marty Robbins covering the Sons of the Pioneers' Cool Water. Okay, I know the episodes seem to be shortening a bit, but as we wind down our life up here in the Adirondacks, I've been extremely busy crossing my T's and dotting my I's. But I hope you enjoyed this episode 8. And before we finish with another closing song by Freda Epstein, I want to invite you to contact me with any thoughts, comments, or suggestions regarding the show at fromthehipradio@gmail.com. And now, here's Freda from her album Global Lullabies. This is the Yiddish lullaby, Umar Mine. See you next week.
Wer kennt die Schönheit von eurem Fachstehen? Wer kennt die Schein von deinen Augen sehen? Und mit zerrissen werden, so sein Herz verfriert. Und mit zerrissen werden, so sein Herz verleiht. Du, unsere meine, du. Du, unsere meine, du. Fach, was bin ich, also in so, es geht doch nicht wieder nach der Tod. Und nur ich trag von dir, und nur ich träum von dir, von dir, von dir. Du Leben meinst, du Herz mir. geht doch nie ein Weg nach der Tor. Und nur ich trage von dir, trage von